identification. This is the first of the Boyer lectures, recorded in 307 on the 4th of September 1989, for broadcast on the 1st of November 1989. End of ident.
The astonishing new developments in biology and genetics that have taken place over the last 30 years or so have made possible a whole new branch of technology which permits us to intervene in the processes of life itself and to some extent to shape and reshape human nature to our own design. The revolution in industrial technology in the 19th century was built upon the scientific revolution of the 17th and 18th centuries. And in much the same way, the revolution in biological and genetic technology derives from recent scientific discoveries about the genetic mechanisms of living beings. So, from an understanding of the genetic code which controls the development of different kinds of living organisms, including humans, ways have been found to manipulate the genetic mechanisms, and so to create in the laboratory new forms of life that don't exist in nature, and also to modify the genetic makeup of plants and animals and humans. Ways have also been found to screen certain genetic defects and malfunctions in human beings, and by appropriate genetic manipulation to prevent or alleviate some of those defects. It's important not to present these new developments and the possibilities they open up in overdramatic, science fiction, brave new world terms. We must, of course, be aware of the possible uses and misuses that may be made of biotechnology, but it distorts our thinking about the moral or human implications of genetic therapy and other forms of biotechnology if we're always discussing them in terms of extreme and unreal possibilities. Those extreme scenarios make imaginative science fiction and sensational journalism an exciting polemic, but they don't really help us to advance the truth. Hard cases make bad law, and extreme cases make for bad ethical thinking. The new forms of biotechnology, genetic engineering, genetic therapy, in vitro fertilization and other modes of artificial reproduction, all promise great human benefits. At the same time, they also raise formidable ethical and social problems for which there's no precedent. Our ordinary ethical and social and legal principles and categories simply can't cope with the novel issues raised by, for example, the manufacture of totally new living organisms by genetic engineering, the creation of human embryos outside their mothers' bodies by in vitro fertilization, the manipulation of people's genetic makeup to remedy certain kinds of diseases, and so on. We don't even have the language to talk about the radically new situations and circumstances that the technology of the processes of human life brings about. For example, it's now possible for a woman who can't bear or gestate a child to have her own ovum fertilized by her husband's sperm in a petri dish, and then for the embryo to be transferred to another woman who acts as a surrogate and who will gestate the embryo. This means that we then have a clear distinction between the genetic mother who supplies the ovum, the gestating mother who bears the child, and in some cases the social mother who cares for the child when it's born. So the possibilities opened up by in vitro fertilization mean that the basic term mother may now signify at least three quite different things. We'll have to invent new terms to describe the relationships between the various kinds of parents that a child may have. We'll also have to decide who should be deemed to be the real mother for the purposes of the law. If the concept of motherhood can be made problematic in this way, we may well wonder whether any concept is safe. In response to the radically new problems raised by the various forms of biotechnology, there's been an explosion of interest in what is now called bioethics, the discussion of the ethical and social implications of biotechnology. I'm not at all sure, by the way, that the term bioethics is a happy one, since it rather gives the impression that it is a special and separate discipline with its own set of principles and categories. In fact, it's simply a branch of ethics, and more particularly of medical ethics. Bioethics has no doubt a special subject matter, but the principles it uses are the same ethical principles we use in everyday life, and which are not special or peculiar to biological and genetic technology. I'm also not happy with the term biotechnology, since it carries a connotation of the machine and of engineering, and sounds rather inhuman. However, we seem to be stuck with both terms, bioethics and biotechnology, so it's not much use repining. At all events, bioethics is now a major industry in the United States and Canada, as well as in England and France and other European countries. In fact, in the United States, one sometimes gets the impression that there are more bioethicists than biotechnologists. I was told recently that there are now almost 2,000 professional ethicists employed by hospitals and clinics and medical research institutes in the United States. There are also large and prestigious institutes of bioethics in the United States, such as those at Georgetown University and the Hastings Institute of Society, Ethics and Life Sciences, and at McGill University in Montreal in Canada. One could, in fact, go to a bioethics conference somewhere in North America every second week. Again, there are government committees, such as the French National Consultative Committee on Ethics and the Life and Health Sciences, and the newly formed Congressional Biomedical Ethics Board in the United States, and a similar committee of the Council of Europe. In addition, books and journals, and even encyclopedias dealing with the ethical implications of the new biotechnology, proliferate and abound. Bioethics has arrived. It's well known that Australia has been in the forefront of some forms of biotechnology, especially in the field of in vitro fertilization and reproductive technology. But Australia is also in the forefront of bioethical discussion. When one surveys the Australian scene, one can't but be impressed by the quantity and high quality of the various reports and studies that have issued from government committees. Again, there are institutes such as the Monash Centre for Human Bioethics, the St. Vincent's Bioethics Centre in Melbourne, the Bonhoeffer Institute in Adelaide. There are also studies by the Anglican Church, the Uniting Church, and various Catholic bodies. And one must also mention the vigorous Australian feminist critique of the new reproductive technology. And I'd include the remarkable book on surrogate motherhood, My Sister's Child, by Maggie and Linda Kirkman. In addition, there are a number of Australian thinkers who are known internationally for their contributions to this field. One could cite, for example, Mr. Justice Michael Kirby, Professor Peter Singer, Dr. Robin Rowland, Professor Louis Waller, Dr. Helga Kuser, Dr. Davis McCackie. When one adds up all these contributions, it amounts to a very rich and impressive body of discussion. Of course, that discussion is extremely various and controversial, often divided and polarized, but that's wholly to be expected. It should be mentioned also that Australia was the first country in the world to enact legislation to control reproductive technology. The Victorian Infertility Medical Procedures Act was passed in 1984, and this was followed by the South Australian Reproductive Technology Act in 1988. Finally, the federal government has recently set up a National Bioethics Consultative Committee to advise the federal and state governments on everything to do with the new forms of biotechnology. This is one of the few national bodies in the world concerned with bioethics. As I said before, the range and quality of Australian bioethics discussion over the last few years has been quite remarkable. I think that, taken as a whole, it's superior to, and in a sense much more radical and imaginative than in most other countries. I find that when I go to Europe or the United States, people in the field are enormously impressed by the Australian contribution to bioethics and anxious to know the latest. This is one area, along with Australian films and Australian wines, where we don't have to adopt a posture of cultural cringe. I may perhaps have given the oversimplified impression that by applying ethical principles to the novel developments in biotechnology, we're able to solve the problems they raise, and so lay the basis for some kind of community consensus about them. But if we're to be realistic about what's possible in bioethics, we have to reject the naive view of ethical reasoning, which sees it as the application of unproblematic general principles or rules to unproblematic particular cases. For example, taking an innocent human life is ethically wrong. Destroying a 20-hour-old in vitro embryo is tantamount to taking innocent human life. Therefore, destroying a 20-hour-old in vitro embryo as part of experimental research is ethically wrong. QED. However, this syllogistic or geometrical kind of reasoning is hardly ever possible in ethical discussion, since in very many cases both the principle and the description of the particular case are problematic. So, for example, the definition of taking a human life requires interpretation, since there are occasions on which we can justifiably bring about the death of an innocent human being. Some people think, for example, that in certain circumstances it would be ethically right to engage in nuclear warfare, and so knowingly and intentionally bring about the death of millions of innocent people. Then again, whether or not a 20-hour-old in vitro embryo is a human being also requires interpretation, since it's certainly not obvious, without some kind of argument, that it is a human being in the ordinary sense of that word. The law certainly doesn't recognize it to be so. Further, there's always the possibility of a conflict between ethical principles. Thus, a woman might argue that the ethical principle of autonomy, that gives people the right to make their own decisions for themselves, allows her to refuse to have a genetically impaired in vitro embryo transferred into her womb. It is, after all, her body. On the other hand, it might be argued that the embryo is a human being of some kind, and that therefore the principle that innocent human life must be respected applies in this situation. Here we have a conflict between two ethical principles, and it's not at all clear how the conflict might be resolved. Some people think that such ethical dilemmas are rare and extraordinary, and that if we reflect about a situation hard enough and long enough, we'll then be able to see which principle should apply and how the problem should be resolved. But in fact, these kinds of conflicts and dilemmas are endemic to the realm of everyday ethical decision-making. Here also, larger considerations come into play in that some people adopt absolutist ethical stances, while others adopt more pragmatic or consequentialist stances. The Gilbert and Sullivan song has it that everyone is born either a little liberal or a little conservative. But I almost think that people are also born either ethical absolutists or ethical consequentialists. The ethical absolutist says, in effect, that certain things are right or wrong regardless of the consequences. As Cardinal Newman once put it, "Even though the heavens should fall, I couldn't tell a lie." The consequentialist, on the other hand, argues that we can judge whether a given action is right or wrong only by looking at the possible consequences of the action. If your action is likely to bring about more general happiness than unhappiness, then it's ethically good. If it's likely to bring about more unhappiness than happiness, it's ethically bad. The absolutist tends to view the consequentialist as an unprincipled pragmatist for whom the end justifies any means, while a consequentialist tends to view the absolutist as a kind of ethical fascist who prefers the purity of principles to the needs of people. Cardinal Newman can keep his precious conscience clean while the heavens are falling on the rest of us. Ethical discussion, therefore, often takes place between people with widely differing interpretations of what the terms of the discussion mean, how the facts may be interpreted or described, and also with differing ethical stances. Sidney Smith once said to a couple of harridans shouting abuse at each other across the street from their doorways, "Ladies, you'll never agree. You're arguing from different premises." A good deal of the debate in bioethics is rather like this. It's rarely a business of applying agreed-upon ethical principles to an unproblematic, agreed-upon set of facts. Very often, people are arguing, like Sidney Smith's London harpies, from very different premises. This is all the more so in a pluralist society, such as Australia is, where there are wide and deep differences about religious and moral values. Societies such as ours not only tolerate fundamentally different religious and moral and philosophical values, but they make a positive virtue out of this plurality of views and values and see it as a sign of social health. But this same pluralism sets limits to the kind of consensus that we can expect in our society. In particular, it sets severe limits to any kind of bioethical consensus vis-à-vis the problems of biotechnology. There's also another factor which deeply influences the way we look at and judge the new biotechnology, namely the curiously ambivalent attitude that people in our society have to science and technology in general. On the one hand, science and technology are thought to be good things. They give us power over nature and liberate us from the determinisms of nature. Thus, the biosciences enable us to control, at least to some degree, our own biological and genetic mechanisms, and so liberate us from the effects of the biological and genetic lottery. We no longer have to accept passively what nature deals out to us. Biology and genetics are no longer destiny. On the other hand, there's a real, if inarticulate, fear that science and technology will get out of control and turn against us and become instruments of dehumanization. There's also the feeling that science and technology are animated by a Promethean intention to play God, This is not a specifically Judeo-Christian view, though there are Christian forms of it, since it goes back to the ancient Greek idea that disaster follows when human beings try to usurp the power of the gods. Thus Prometheus, the first mythical technologist, defied the gods by stealing fire from them and giving it to humans. This ambivalence, seeing science and technology as a means of human liberation on the one hand, and on the other hand seeing science and technology as tainted by Promethean hubris, is not just a recognition that science and technology can be used for good or bad purposes. It stems rather from the recognition that scientific knowledge and technological power are not, as the optimistic and utopian 17th and 18th century view of science pretended, automatically means of human empowerment and liberation, as though there was some kind of pre-established harmony directed by some hidden hand between the progress of science and technology and the progress and happiness of humanity. On the contrary, scientific knowledge and technology contain tragic possibilities, in the Greek sense of tragedy, and can easily lead us to being punished by the gods for our presumption. If we emphasize one side of this ambivalence, we end up with a pessimistic view of technology, which, while acknowledging technology's benefits, dwells more upon its potentialities for human alienation and enslavement. I call this view of technology techno-pessimism. If we emphasize the other side, we end up with a view which, while admitting the possibilities of misuse, sees a happy coincidence between technological progress and human happiness. I call this view techno-optimism. What I've called techno-pessimism can be seen in a great deal of 19th century and early 20th century literature. For example, in Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story The Birthmark and his novel The Scarlet Letter, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, George Eliot's Middlemarch, and of course a number of H.G. Wells's novels. In these writings, the scientist is presented partly as a beneficent sage unlocking the mysteries of nature and helping humanity, partly as a magus unleashing forces that he, it's always a he in 19th century science fiction, cannot fully control, partly as a Faustian figure in league with preternatural forces. So, in Mary Shelley's novel, Frankenstein, Victor Frankenstein speaks of being influenced at the University of Ingolstadt by the great chemist, Waldman. The chemists, Waldman says, have indeed performed miracles. They penetrate into the recesses of nature and shows how she works in her hiding places. They ascend into the heavens. They've discovered how the blood circulates and the nature of the air we breathe. They've acquired new and almost unlimited powers. They can command the thunders of heaven, mimic the invisible world with its own shadows. Inspired by Waldman, Victor Frankenstein sees himself as unfolding the deepest mysteries of creation and of having the power of creating life itself, in other words, being able to play God. But of course, Frankenstein creates a monster who first haunts and persecutes him, and then destroys him. Mary Shelley's novel was subtitled The Modern Prometheus, and it presents very powerfully the curious mixture of optimism and pessimism, attraction and fear, that our culture has to science and technology. In our own times, the pessimistic side of this attitude has emerged in the general critique of autonomous technology that's come from thinkers such as Lewis Mumford, Langdon Winner, and Jacques Ellul, and also from the environmentalist and green movements. This pessimistic view of technology in general has been carried over into the specific field of biotechnology, not only by some bioscientists, but also by Christian fundamentalists, an important section of the feminist movement, the conservative wing of the Catholic Church, environmentalists and green activists, and even by some neo-Marxists. However, if all these groups are suspicious of and pessimistically cautious about biotechnology and its various manifestations, they are so for very different reasons. There are, for example, Christian fundamentalists, very powerful in the United States, who hold that genetic engineering and genetic therapy and the various kinds of reproductive engineering are wrong because they're attempting to interfere with the springs and processes of human life, a sacred province which belongs to God alone. God has created human nature, and human beings shouldn't interfere with it. Again, some Protestant theologians, such as Paul Ramsey, argue that the attempt by human beings to control their future through genetic technology involves a temptation to play God, and so to deny our status as creatures. Ramsey has a nice story, by the way, about doctors playing God. The Pope, the Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem, and the General Secretary of the World Council of Churches all arrived in heaven on the same day. Despite their eminence on earth, they didn't have much seniority in heaven, so they had to take a rather lowly place in the cafeteria queue. After some holy protest, they were waiting their turn, when suddenly a little man in a white coat came in and rushed to the front of the queue. "Who in heaven is that?" asked the Pope with some resentment. "Oh, that's God," one of the angels said. "He thinks he's a doctor." Some Catholics, though by no means all, also take up a pessimistic attitude to the new biotechnology, particularly with regard to in vitro fertilization. So the 1987 statement by the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith argued that in vitro fertilization was an attempt to technologize human reproduction and to divorce it from human sexual love in marriage. The rejection of, or pessimism about, biotechnology is not, however, necessarily tied to a religious position. Certain bioscientists have argued, for example, that genetic engineering is dangerous because it may interfere with the evolutionary process itself. So, one of the famous figures of modern biology, Erwin Chagov, has issued a statement entitled On the Dangers of Genetic Meddling. In his statement, Chagov castigates the genetic engineers for perpetrating what he calls an irreversible attack on the biosphere, so unheard of, so unthinkable to previous generations, that I could only wish that mine had not been guilty of it. The hybridization of Prometheus with Herostratus is bound to give evil results. Prometheus defied the gods by stealing fire from them and giving it to humans, and Herostratus burned down the temple at Ephesus to give himself a name in history. Have we the right, Chagov continues, to counteract irreversibly the evolutionary wisdom of millions of years in order to satisfy the ambition and curiosity of a few scientists? The world is given to us on loan. We come and we go, and after a time we leave earth and air and water to others who come after us. My generation, or perhaps the one preceding mine, has been the first to engage, under the leadership of the exact sciences, in a destructive colonial war against nature, and the future will curse us for it. Perhaps the most interesting and vigorous opposition to biotechnology has come from the feminist movement, associated with FinRage, an international feminist network of resistance to genetic and reproductive technology in all its forms. The American, Gina Correa, is the author of the book The Mother Machine, Reproductive Technologies from Artificial Insemination to the Artificial Womb, and who's one of the founders of FinRage, sees biotechnology as an instrument of male exploitation and oppression. In particular, she sees in vitro fertilization as an attempt by male medical scientists to make reproduction a dehumanized mechanical business, and so to take the reproductive process out of women's control. Speaking at a conference in 1988, Gina Correa concluded her address as follows. Let me come back now to the question I was asked to address here, whether the new reproductive technologies will enable women to exercise greater control over our reproduction. I'll restate the question. When women are fully reduced to reproductive meat, will we be in control of our lives? When we're nothing more than the raw materials used in a new industrial process, will we be free? When women are interchangeable parts in the birth machinery, will we be liberated? Now I can give my answer. No. A well-known Australian feminist, Dr. Robin Rowland, also takes a similar attitude to the new forms of reproductive technology, which, so she argues, will lead to increased male control of the reproductive process. The future of women as a group, she says, is at stake, and we need to ensure that we have thoroughly considered all possibilities before endorsing technology which could mean the death of the female. Gina Correa and Robin Rowland and other feminists resist the idea that biotechnology is neutral in itself and only becomes good or bad when it's used for good or bad purposes. In fact, so they say, biotechnology is socially constructed and it's impregnated with values. It is in reality the expression of a male technocratic ideology. If we look at an individual case, an infertile woman may see in vitro fertilization simply as a means of overcoming her infertility. But in fact, the technique of in vitro fertilization is embedded in a whole set of anti-woman values, and you can't detach the technique from those values. In much the same way, some neo-Marxist thinkers see biotechnology in its present form as an expression of the technocratic and dehumanizing values of our capitalist society. At the other extreme from the techno-pessimist position I've just been describing, there is the utopian or optimistic view, which sees the new biotechnology as a means of human liberation from the determinisms of nature. Just as the older industrial technology freed human beings from much of the oppressive drudgery of work, so the new biotechnology will, so it's claimed, free us from many of our biological limitations and give us a choice, so that we will be able to control the very processes of life itself. The same equation that was used in the 18th and 19th centuries to justify science and technology, scientific knowledge leads to technological power, and technological power leads to human liberation, that equation is now used to justify biological science and genetics and biotechnology. It's admitted that there are, of course, potentialities for misuse, but we may be sure that any possible evils will be outweighed by the benefits. So Dr. Robert Edwards, one of the founding fathers of in vitro fertilization, has this to say: "I believe that the work should go on, responsibly and carefully, that it doesn't offer threats to society or debase it, that the good far outweighs any harm. Neither society nor family life is strengthened by the spectre of the infertile couple, of the severely handicapped at birth, or the suffering adult. Our infertile patients express as much love towards each other and their children as those conceived by sexual intercourse. The methods are different, but the love is the same. I can't agree with those who wish to maintain the status quo, to leave the infertile uncured, or resist new approaches to averting abnormal growth. To do nothing is just as much an ethical decision to be defended as to introduce new methods of therapy, and the onus of proof must fall on them." This is, I suppose, the standard view of most practicing bioscientists and biotechnologists, and it's also the view of many other people. But it's a very different view from that shared by the various techno-pessimists I discussed before. In my view, we have to find some kind of middle way between these two positions. I don't know what one should call a middle way between optimism and pessimism. Once reminded of the Irish preacher's sermon, "Brethren, we must choose the straight and narrow way between good and evil." But on the one hand, I don't think that we should be negative towards, or suspicious and fearful about, technology in general and biotechnology in particular. And on the other hand, I don't believe all biotechnological developments are ipso facto good, nor that they're so inevitable and irresistible that we have no choice about them. Nor do I think that there's some kind of pre-established harmony between biotechnological progress and human happiness. There's no technological imperative, and I believe that we can say yes to some developments in biological and genetic technology and no to others. Perhaps this position could be called realistic optimism or hopeful pessimism. This middle way is not a weak need or fence-sitting compromise. It is, in fact, much more difficult to think each issue through as patiently and as reasonably as one can without relying on an a priori ideological position, whether the right or the left. This kind of patient and reasonable debate about the formidable human problems posed by the new forms of biotechnology is the one thing necessary at the present time. As I said before, we have to recognize the limits of that discussion, and our expectations should be modest. Hegel once said, "Das Denken ist schwer," thinking is hard work, and thinking in this realm is especially hard work. But then bioethics, like life itself, as someone once remarked, wasn't meant to be easy.
Identification. This is tape number 2 of the Boyer Lectures, Life, Death, Genes and Ethics. End of identification.
Until very recently, there was virtually only one way of being born. You got yourself a male and female parent and let nature take its course. Now, however, there are a number of alternative ways of being born, a variety of so-called reproductive technologies. You can be born through artificial insemination by donor, or through the in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer technique, or the gamete intrafallopian transfer technique. Or again, your father and mother might contribute sperm and ova, and fertilization might take place in a petri dish, and the embryo that will become you might then be transferred to the womb of a surrogate mother, who will gestate and give birth to a child, you, that's not genetically hers. Some even speak of the possibility in the future of developing a human embryo and fetus outside a woman's womb altogether. The mechanical womb, however, is likely to remain in the realm of science fiction, and in my view, we really shouldn't try to discuss the ethics of artificial reproduction by looking at such bizarre and improbable possibilities. There is, of course, no reason to think that these alternative modes of giving birth will ever take the place of normal reproduction. 99.9% of human beings will continue to be born in the old-fashioned and time-honored way. But for many infertile couples who can't have children in the old-fashioned and time-honored way, these new reproductive technologies are a possible means, if a couple is lucky, of having a child. As we are all aware, in vitro fertilization and the other forms of artificial reproduction raise formidable ethical questions. To some extent, those problems have come up in the past apropos abortion, but they've been given a new dimension because, at least in in vitro fertilization, the human embryo, in its first stages of development, exists independently of its mother. So it can be frozen, stored, donated, and transferred to another woman, and it can also be experimented upon. As a result, many thorny questions arise. Is the embryo in the petri dish or in cold storage a human being, or when does it become a human being? What is the moral status of the embryo? Does it have any rights? Can we experiment upon human embryos? Should an in vitro embryo be implanted in and gestated by a surrogate mother? What is the status of so-called excess embryos that are formed by in vitro fertilization and then not transferred to a woman? And what are the woman's rights in vitro fertilization? Do women run the risk of being treated as experimental subjects so that their control over their reproductive processes is effectively taken from them by the very technology which claims to liberate them? Who should control this technology, and how should that control be exercised? Let's begin with the beginning of human life, the moment when the male sperm penetrates the outer membrane of the female ovum and sets in train the incredibly complex process that, if all goes well, will culminate in the birth of a human child. The process of fertilization is not an instantaneous event, but takes place over some 20 hours until the chromosomes you get from your mother are aligned with the chromosomes you get from your father to produce the code or set of instructions that will govern your subsequent development. At this stage, however, the set of cells are still in an undetermined state, in that they can develop in a number of different ways. They might develop into one individual entity, or they might develop into two individuals, twins, or they might develop abnormally or pathologically. It's only at day 14 of the embryo's development that we can be sure that there is an individual organism or entity there. And it is, of course, much later that the embryo looks anything like a human being and develops rudimentary human characteristics. Then again, for the first two-thirds of its development, the embryo and fetus is totally dependent on its mother, and it's only in the last 3 months that it can survive if it's born prematurely. During this whole process, a human organism is developing, with one phase preparing for and giving way to another, more complex phase. As the United Kingdom Warnock Committee put it, once the process has begun, there's no particular point of the developmental process that is more important than another. All are part of a continuous process, and unless each stage takes place normally, at the correct time, and in the correct sequence, further development will cease. There's no doubt that this developing organism is, biologically and genetically speaking, a member of the species Homo sapiens, and not of some other animal species. But when does that biologically human entity become a distinctively human being, an individual with a moral status and rights that determine how we should treat it? Put in another way, when does the biologically human organism become an individual person with a claim to be treated exactly as we treat any other human person? There has, of course, been an enormous amount of ink spilt over this question, but in my view, the debate has been confused by two things. First, it's been supposed by people on both sides of the discussion that we can argue directly from biological and scientific evidence about the development of the human embryo to a non-biological and non-scientific conclusion about the moral status and rights of the embryo. However, while biological evidence may be more or less relevant, it can't really tell us conclusively whether an organism is to be given a special value and status and treated in a special way. One can't, as a matter of logic, base philosophical and moral conclusions about the human person directly on scientific evidence. I think, then, it's a vain hope that we'll be able to determine when a human person comes into existence simply by inspecting the biological and genetic evidence about the development of the embryo. Even if we agree that an individual biological entity emerges at day 14 with the formation of a rudimentary nervous system, this doesn't tell us whether that individual entity is a person with a distinctively moral value and status. Christian theologians in the Middle Ages made this same point by saying that we didn't know and couldn't know, just on the empirical evidence, when the biological matter of the embryo was infused or informed by a soul. It's worthwhile making the point, by the way, that Catholic theologians from the 13th to the 18th centuries didn't recognize the embryo as a human being until it was visibly human in form, as they put it, that is, roughly 40 days after conception. The second confusion, which has bedeviled the debate about the beginning of human life, arises from not attending to the very simple fact that we're dealing with a continuum. There are many kinds of continua. An interval of time is a continuum in that each phase precedes and gives way to another, in such a way that we can't divide it up into discrete atomic bits. No matter how finely you divide an interval of time up, you'll always be left with an interval which can be divided up still further. Time is infinitely divisible. We may, of course, for practical purposes, divide an interval of time up into what we call hours, minutes, seconds, and so on, but these divisions are always arbitrary to some extent. There's nothing absolute about them. As St. Augustine pointed out long ago, we can't measure the present moment and say when it begins and ends, since that would imply that the present moment had a duration. Though for practical purposes, we may say that it is now 3 p.m. on December the 30th, A.D. 2001. Some continua are developmental in the sense that while they occur in time, each phase prepares for and gives way to a more complex phase. These developmental phases run into each other, and you can't really find a definitive or absolute point in the developmental process where you can say, for example, this is now no longer an acorn but an oak tree, or this is now no longer a collection of living cells but an animal. Just because of the peculiar nature of continua, any divisions we make in them are bound to be arbitrary. We're all aware of this simple and obvious fact in the development of human beings after birth. So we distinguish in a rough-and-ready way between infancy, childhood, adolescence, and adulthood. But at the same time, we realize that none of these distinctions are definitive or absolute. In our society, we select 18 as the age when a person is deemed to be an adult. But there's nothing mystical about 18. It's just that for practical purposes, allowing people to vote or to get married, we need to have some defined age limit, and so we choose 18. The choice is not wholly arbitrary, since obviously 12 years of age would be too young and 25 would be too old. But it remains true that there's nothing special about 18. It's not a definitive event, although, of course, the fact that 18 has been chosen can have very large consequences. In some countries, you can be executed for certain crimes if you're over the age of 18. As I've said, we're quite happy to proceed in this rough-and-ready or arbitrary way about the developmental phases of human beings outside the womb. But we then imagine that we can be much more precise and absolute about the development of human beings inside the womb. So, as we've seen, some have argued that the crucial moment is when the sperm penetrates the outer membrane of the ovum and begins fusing with the ovum. Others have pointed out that fertilization is not an instantaneous event, but takes place over 20 hours and ends only at the stage called syngamy, when the male and female chromosomes get together. So syngamy has been claimed as the crucial moment when the human being begins. Others again have argued that it's only at 14 days that an individual entity emerges with a rudimentary nervous system, and that this is the definitive marker event. An Australian Catholic theologian, Father Norman Ford, has recently argued that it's only at day 14 that the embryo becomes an individual living being. If I want to say when I, this individual, began, then it was at day 14. What's extraordinary about these definitions is that their respective supporters seem to suppose that we can give an absolutely precise account of the crucial moment when the human being begins. It's as though we could measure that moment with a stopwatch and say, now, a human being has just begun. In fact, we can only make rough-and-ready decisions about when the human embryo becomes a human person, and for practical reasons, we more or less arbitrarily deem it to be a human person at such and such a stage, and treat it as though it were a human person. The question we should be asking, then, is not, when does the human person begin, as though there could be some kind of definitive answer to that question, but for what practical reasons should we deem the human embryo or fetus at such and such a stage to be a human person, and treat it as though it were a human person? In the debate about reproductive technology, the main opposition has come from a conservative group of Catholic theologians and from a powerful group of feminists. In this area, anomalies abound, but this de facto alliance between conservative Catholics and radical feminists is surely the most curious of all. There are a number of Catholic positions on artificial reproduction, but the main, quasi-official position at the present time is that in vitro fertilization is an unethical practice since it divorces the act of conception from the act of sexual intercourse, which is, or ought to be, the expression of love between the couple. In vitro fertilization represents the technologization of something that is profoundly and centrally human. There are also a number of feminist positions on artificial reproduction. Some feminists see in vitro fertilization as a means of reproductive liberation. However, a widely held feminist view at the present time is that in vitro fertilization is part of a male patriarchalist attempt to take reproduction out of the control of women, and also to use women as experimental subjects for scientific research. According to this view, while it appears to offer women a means of liberation, the new technology in fact subjugates them to male-dominated medicine and the prevailing patriarchalist ideology. These Catholic and feminist critiques of reproductive technology are important, and I'd like to say something about them. With regard to the conservative Catholic view, it's difficult to see why an infertile couple who wish to bring a child into the world can't use the in vitro fertilization technique to help them procreate the child with the same loving intention that animates their other acts of sexual intercourse. In any case, it could be argued that many acts of sexual intercourse which result in the procreation of children are not acts of human love. Again, the use of in vitro fertilization doesn't necessarily result in the domination of human procreation by technology. It is, after all, up to the infertile couple to use and control the technology for their own purposes. No doubt, in vitro fertilization opens up possibilities for various dubious practices, but we can hardly reject it on the grounds that it may be misused. I sometimes imagine a rather bizarre scenario. Let's suppose that we knew nothing at all about sexuality, which God forbid, and then some biotechnological breakthrough made sexuality possible. I'm sure that various people would oppose this new biotechnology on the grounds that A, it would give people the idea that they could play God by creating human life, B, it would be used to dominate women and make them into sex objects, C, it would be likely to cause more human unhappiness than happiness. D, it would lead inevitably to the vices and perversities of people like the Marquis de Sade. All of these implications of sexuality have, of course, been realized, but I don't see this as a conclusive argument against the invention of sexuality. It's worthwhile making the point here, by the way, that the distinction between what is natural in human reproduction and what is artificial and technological is not absolute. It is, after all, a contingent matter that we have the sexual apparatus we do have, and that the process of human reproduction is as it is. After all, our reproductive plumbing might have been arranged very differently. In her novel, Left Hand of Darkness, Ursula Le Guin imagines a world where human beings are not divided into male and female, but are ambisexual, and that they can be in a male phase at one time and in a female phase at another time. These two-sexed humans inhabit a planet called Gethin, and a male visitor arrives in Gethin from planet Earth. In the Gwyn story, this unisex person is known to the people of Gethin as the pervert. On Gethin, the visitor from Earth reflects. They don't see one another as men or women. A man wants his virility regarded, a woman wants her femininity appreciated. But on Gethin, one is respected and judged only as a human being. It is an appalling experience. With regard to the feminist opposition to in vitro fertilization, the arguments used here are of a mixed kind. Partly they're directed against current practices in vitro fertilization, such as the use of superovulatory drugs and certain surgical techniques, the use of women as experimental subjects, the low success rate of in vitro fertilization as a treatment for infertility, and the diversion of scarce medical resources to in vitro fertilization and away from preventative measures against infertility. However, even if all these things were remedied, the feminist opponents of in vitro fertilization wouldn't be satisfied, since they see in vitro fertilization as bound up with a patriarchalist and pronatalist ideology. So, some feminist thinkers claim that men are envious of the primary role that women play in human procreation, a kind of uterus envy, and that in vitro fertilization is a way of men trying to get control of the reproductive process. As Gina Correa has put it, woman, once deified as the life-creating goddess, is now lying on a table with her mouth taped shut, having the egg sucked out of her body. Correa also claims that this attack on women's reproductive power goes together, somewhat paradoxically, with a pronatalist ideology. As she says, the pronatalist ideology that women are nothing unless they bear children, that if they're infertile, they lose their most basic identity as women, has a coercive power. In other words, women who see in vitro fertilization simply as a means of overcoming their infertility and having a child, because they like children and want to have one, these women have been ideologically brainwashed into believing that they can't really be women if they don't have children. Some of these feminist criticisms have a good deal of point. In particular, they remind us very forcibly that it's not just the interests of children that need to be kept in view, but also the interests of the women who undergo in vitro fertilization procedures. A recent writer has said, there is endless discussion of the moral status of the fertilized ovum or pre-embryo and its possible moral rights. But with the exception of a small group of feminist critics, few have paid much attention to the dangers to the women who serve as experimental subjects in reproductive research, and indirectly to all women. However, it's difficult to see how one can move from evidence about particular abuses and complaints about male-dominated medicine to a blanket condemnation of reproductive technology as a whole. An American feminist philosopher, Marianne Warren, has made this point very clearly. After defending women's right to reproductive autonomy, the right to make one's own choices about how one procreates or doesn't procreate a child, Warren argues that if women's right to reproductive autonomy means anything, it must mean that we're entitled to take some risk with our physical and psychological health in the attempt to either have or not have children. Neither abortion nor many forms of contraception are entirely safe, but women sometimes reasonably judge that the alternatives are even less desirable. Having a wanted child can be as important a goal as avoiding an unwanted birth. If the costs and dangers of IVF to individual women and children were so great that no informed and responsible person would attempt that route to parenthood, then perhaps the paternalistic protection of women through the prohibition of IVF would be appropriate. But if these costs and dangers are not, as far as we can now determine, so great as to clearly outweigh the possible benefits, then the matter is properly left to individual choice. Warren goes on to argue for more control by women of reproductive technology, and in my view, this is the crucial point. While at present some in vitro scientists may carry on in an insensitive male macho way, there's no reason why in vitro fertilization can't be controlled by the women and couples in vitro fertilization programs. Childbirth has now to some extent been demedicalized, and there's no reason why the new artificial reproduction techniques shouldn't also be made more responsive to the wishes and needs of infertile women and men. In a 1985 report of a select committee of the Australian Senate on the issue of embryo experimentation, a dissenting minority view was put forward by Senators Rosemary Crowley and Olive Zakharov. Crowley and Zakharov argued that, practically speaking, it was the IVF couple who had to make decisions about any embryos formed from their sperm and ova. One can't force a woman to have any of her IVF embryos implanted in her, and it's a matter of choice for her and her partner whether they be implanted or not. From this point of view, then, the IVF couple has effective control over the IVF process. As Crowley and Zakharov put it, an embryo can't make decisions for itself. Its future is decided by others. It has potential only in virtue of decisions by others about it, since without implantation in the uterus, there's no development of an embryo. Our major argument, they go on, is that responsible decision-makers, either the donors or the woman into whose uterus the embryo would be placed, should make decisions about it. With regard to so-called excess or non-transferred embryos, Crowley and Zakharov argue that some responsible decision-makers will choose to allow the embryo to succumb. Others will allow such spare embryos to be the subject of experimentation prior to succumbing, for the good of society, for gaining of knowledge, for improvement of technique of the IVF program, while some will decide that they be made available for other couples. This view that the IVF couple should as far as possible have control over the IVF technology also lies behind recent amendments made to the Victorian Infertility Medical Procedures Act of 1984. The amendment allows experimentation under strictly controlled conditions on embryos before the stage of embryonic development known as syngamy, which occurs at roughly 20 hours into the development of the fertilized ovum. In my opinion, a major feature of the amendment is its insistence that any embryo experimentation be done within the context of the ongoing IVF process, as it involves and affects couples in that process. In other words, it's not possible for medical scientists to create their own presyngamous embryos for experimentation by using sperm and ova from anywhere, so to speak. According to the amendment, the ova must come from a married woman who has been or is presently undergoing IVF treatment, and she and her husband must both be appraised of the purpose of the experiment and freely consent to it. Further, the experiment must be shown to benefit couples in a specific way. In other words, embryo experimentation shouldn't become a matter of pure scientific research without regard to the specific needs of IVF couples. The intention of the amendment was to place the emphasis upon the IVF couples taking the initiative and using the experimental expertise of the medical scientists for their own purpose. The whole raison d'etre of the Victorian Infertility Medical Procedures Act is that childless couples should be assisted in their desire to have children, and the main actors and controlling agents in the IVF process, including embryo experimentation, ought to be the couple themselves and not the medical scientists. To make this completely effective, we would no doubt have to rethink the present system of healthcare and the paternalistic physician-patient relationship it enshrines. As an American observer has put it, more attention should be devoted to health education to enable patients to control their own program of treatment. Physicians might then be seen primarily as health educators and health consultants, rather than as technical experts with the right of final authority over medical decisions. The notion of patient compliance, the view that the essential task of a patient is to obey doctor's orders, might then be inverted. We might instead ask and study the extent to which physicians attend to patients' definitions of their problems and design treatment plans accordingly. At all events, if in vitro fertilization technology were in some way to be in the control of the IVF couple, and if the physician and medical scientist were in some sense to be the servant of the IVF couple, and many of the problems raised by feminist writers about in vitro fertilization don't seem to be so pressing. I believe that the same is also true of the problems associated with embryo experimentation. The opponents of embryo experimentation tend to give the impression that scientists can do what they like and experiment at will on embryos they've brought into existence for their own scientific purposes. But in fact, experimentation can take place only with the informed consent of the couple who have supplied the ova and sperm, after the nature and import of the experimentation has been made clear to them. Again, permission for the experimentation has to be given by the ethics committee of the hospital or clinic or research institute, and this is given only if the experiment is seen to be serious and necessary. It will also be subject to stringent conditions about its conduct. Furthermore, any experiment will have to be in accordance with the ethical guidelines of the National Health and Medical Research Council. Otherwise, it won't be funded by the council. And if the experiment is being done in Victoria, permission will have to be sought from the Standing Review and Advisory Committee on Infertility, which advises the Minister of Health on what can be done and not done under the Infertility Medical Procedures Act. The crucial thing, however, is that the ultimate control over the experimentation should be in the hands of the couple, since in the last resort it's they who must consent to it being done. The primary question then is not, may scientists experiment on human embryos, but under what conditions can a couple consent to experimentation on untransferred embryos formed from their sperm and ova? Some recent thinkers refer to in vitro fertilization and IVF-assisted surrogacy as collaborative, non-coital forms of procreation, and they urge us to see them positively as new ways of bringing children into existence and of creating a family. No doubt the new procreative technologies can possibly lead to abuses, but they should also be seen as a way of enlarging our choices and giving us greater control over our reproductive destinies. Technology is not necessarily anti-human, as some contemporary Luddites almost seem to suggest. It can enhance our humanity by enlarging our choices and increasing our autonomy. And the same is true of the so-called reproductive technologies. After all this argument and discussion, we ought to remember that, in the last resort, it's all about the birth of a child, the most natural and everyday, and yet the most astonishing human event. In Dostoevsky's extraordinary novel, The Devils, one of the main characters, Shatov, is present at the birth of a child. "Rejoice, Mrs. Verginsky," Shatov says to the matter-of-fact midwife. "It's a great joy." "What great joy are you babbling about?" Mrs. Verginsky said merrily, bustling around, clearing away, and working like a Trojan. "The mystery of the coming of a new human being is a great and incomprehensible mystery, Mrs. Verginsky, and what a pity it is you don't understand it." Shatov muttered incoherently, dazed and entranced. It was as though something was swaying about in his head and pouring out of his soul in spite of himself. There were two, and now there's a third human being, a new spirit, whole and complete, which no human hands can fashion, a new thought and a new love. It makes me feel frightened, and there's nothing bigger in the world.